ongoing dialogue of the God Journey podcast. Many of us are waking up to God's not a formula to be worked. He's a God who loves us, who has a purpose in the world to redeem it back to himself, who will work good in our lives through the most horrible things that we face.
When we first started this whole podcast thing, you and I were trying to come up with a name. I just remember somehow the whole God Journey thing settled.
And we've had people tell us that was a stupid name.
Those just few words say an awful lot of true things. This is my journey. This is just my deal, my little story. It's not about me. I am just a supporting actor in a greater drama that isn't about me.
You're Wayne Jacobson.
And you're Brad Cummings.
I tried to trick you there.
Yeah.
What do you think about cloning?
I was actually listening.
What do you think about cloning?
Cloning.
Because I need one. I got so much work I'm trying to get unburied from. It's all good, but I do. I've now just sort of crossed the threshold of going like, Lord, so what about cloning? Would that be all right? Just for a week?
How's Kelly feel about it?
I think my wife would like one of them, one of the clones, to do the work so that I'm back in the, you know, that's life.
Do you think God wants you living at the margins of your life like this?
No, but I'm just looking for supernatural help. He could send a couple of angels to do some of the busy work I got going on.
He definitely could.
Yeah, he just has it. I haven't seen him yet.
The record in history is, if this is your hope to smooth your schedule out.
God doesn't seem to do temp help like that. It's interesting.
Well, he does a lot of temp help, but I don't think he's going to send. I mean, I'd be housewives praying for the...
But you know what? I did.
I didn't get to finish my thought.
I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, well, I was almost glad I didn't get a chance to finish. I was going to say, housewives would want their floors vacuumed, but then so would house husbands, I would think.
True.
Without
very
being
true.
Too sexist on that point. But cloning, you know, it's one of those things the right wingers are saying that God's not into, so I wouldn't be going
there. Yeah, I really don't think so. I thought, you know, it was a sort of vicarious thought of like, wow, it would be nice if for a moment I had two of me.
It'd be fooling with creation at a level I'm not sure we're going to be allowed to fool with it.
Yeah. Well, don't worry. I really couldn't grow anything but mold in the refrigerator anyway.
You haven't got any lab experiments going in your basement or anything?
No.
Gee, well, that's good to hear. That's kind of scary stuff.
So, hey, this freedom thing, free-range believers, is catching on?
I hope it doesn't become a term in a negative sense, you know, like we're free-range and they're, you know.
Oh, I'm sure it'll be disparaged, but I like the term. It's a good term.
I like the term, too. I like the positive side of it, but yeah. I even blogged on it.
Free-range chickens, that's all good, too.
Free-range chickens. That's what somebody made.
But no,
somebody made the crack on my blog in a comment about the free-range believers versus the caged chickens, talking about those still who go to Sunday morning, and that's the kind of talk I'd love to avoid.
Well, I was thinking about the whole free-range chickens, the whole people that sort of run away from freedom.
There are people who do that.
There are. I mean, I think there was someone on the blog or the forum, whatever, that...
Yeah,
you know,
Kent's a fellow from St. Louis we know well, said, Wayne and Brad, would be helpful to explore a little deeper what you both mentioned about people being afraid of freedom. I hear it said so often, just tell me what to do. Isn't this one of those things that stands in the way? As long as we follow rules and principles, following the Spirit, who is like the wind, will remain totally out of the question. It just seems this is an important thing. Most people would say they want freedom, but then seem to run to the illusions of security, rules, and attempted conformity that such rules create. So freedom isn't something everybody wants.
No, I think it's flat out terrifying sometimes. Freedom takes a whole lot of courage to go into the area where it's like, you don't have a guarantee. Because I mean, I think most of us want some kind of guarantee of success, or at least I'm not going to totally tank it and, you know, mess up. And so we're wanting something that hedges against that. When it's sort of freedom, it's hard for that to not have its subjective domains. And it's like, well, I think most of us are kind of scared of messing up.
And how much of that is just innate to who we are and our flesh and all that? And how much of it has really been programmed in us by feeling like we're going to mess up, we're going to, you know, the fear that living without rules creates? Because it seems that particularly the system of religious obligation is entirely based on rules and finding our security in those rules. And
well, then I know I'm being a good boy. If you tell me the rules, and then I can somehow achieve at least some measure of them.
Follow enough of them, to feel good about
then
me.
Then I get a sense of I'm being a good boy.
Yeah.
And ergo, it probably is going to go well for me, is what I think most people follow that out.
But don't the rules work well only for a specific kind of person?
Yeah, type A, accomplished-driven people.
Well, or Pharisee types.
Sure, yes, Pharisee types.
So I think rules work well for people like me, because I can follow rules. I could conform, you know, going to school, growing up, and, you know, get straight. I could figure out what a teacher wanted and give it to him. I could always figure that out. It wasn't difficult. It just meant I was learning anything. It just meant I could conform to what was expected of me, and I could conform enough externally to get to the top of the class. But I don't think most people are wired that way. I think most people get exhausted, particularly the honest ones, get exhausted by the rules and their failure to live up to them. And then, so they're on a different page, right?
I mean, I think so.
What do we say to them, if anything?
Go free range believers.
Because I was with a guy yesterday. He was asking me, we were at lunch, and he was asking me, he'd like to move in his life from being someone that's all, you know, intellectual ingenuity and decision making and then working hard, the whole confidence in human effort kind of thing. And he said he'd met somebody recently who was talking more about just waiting on God and what was the Holy Spirit doing. And he said, I want to be more like that in my life. Can you tell me how to do it? It was like, can you give me another set of rules to get out of my rules? And I said, you know, I can give you some encouragement as to how you begin to look at that. But if you're looking for three steps to get from a type A human performance deal to I'm going to listen to the Spirit and blow with that wind.
See, but if he's already an English speaker and understands what those words are, it isn't a question about, oh, can you tell me how? It's will you have the courage to actually wait? I mean, most of us sort of feel like, gosh, I'm sitting in a room, it's quiet, and I'm here with the pregnant nothing. And we end up going like, I feel stupid, something's supposed to happen, I don't know how to make it happen. So we pretend like we don't know how. And really what we have is our massive impatience.
I hear you, but no matter how much I explain that to this guy. He looked at me and said, you're not going to tell me, are you?
I had that lunch with you.
I guess not.
I asked you great questions and you never answered any of them.
Yeah, but I think I did. He'll go away saying he didn't answer anything because he was looking for what he was looking for. I wasn't given. That's true. But I was telling him how to begin to wake up in the morning and listen and look for the breath of the Holy Spirit and follow that and shared some stories about how my life transitioned into that. And I got email from him this morning saying, I was really disappointed in our lunch because you didn't answer my question.
Because it didn't come in the package of steps and rules. And
see, I know other people feel that way too. I know other people, when you talk this way, they're looking for something different than we can give them. Because freedom is about you and God sorting some things out while some folks hang around, hold your hand, encourage you and all that. But can't tell you what to do. And people are used to being told what to do, prefer to be told what to do. Can't you just tell me?
Or they like being told what to do so they have at least somebody to resent when they don't like what's going on. I mean, it does allow a buffer of I have someone to blame and accuse.
Now, blame's better than the other word because I'm not sure people really look to resent people, but I do think
I'll
the
blame, be well. Okay,
you
I
look
just,
for
I've been
resent?
The target of some of that, so I sort of figure it's there.
But people fall into resentment.
Okay, whatever.
That'd be unique for
it's
me.
It's a ditch I've met many people in.
Don't give me that whatever stuff.
Okay, sorry. I do think it's a challenge because. Like, people's craving for intimacy, that they want that. But you have to, the only way you get intimacy is if you bring vulnerability to the table. Well, I don't want vulnerability. I mean, I looked at the word. It means able to be wounded. No, not interested. I got my, you know, my armor plating on, going like, I'm not, but I want intimacy. It's like, do we really? And I think it's the schizophrenic nature in a lot of us. Yes, you do. Do I want freedom? Yes, I do. But
you want freedom. Yes,
scary.
I do.
It's scary. It does require a tremendous amount of courage. And I think it requires honesty. And I think it's hard sometimes being honest with ourselves. Because what if I don't like what I see?
Oh, I think that's a big fear for people. I think we've learned that growing up. It's just easier to fit into everybody's expectations of you. When we meet somebody, worried about what we're saying, if they're going to like us or not like us. And that whole pattern is built around, I'm trying to get you to like an illusion of me. Because if I'm trying to act the way you want me to act, I'm not being me. I'm being my best projection of you on me, which isn't me. And I think that's exactly why people get cut out of intimacy. Absolutely.
And the challenge is, okay, how do you peel back all that stuff? And I don't know any shortcut other than just sort of, quote, unplugging from that system of everyone else's expectations and even my own. Because I think there's a lot of people that live under stress, and it's like if you really kind of examine their life, try to figure out who's causing that, well, it's them. It's self-imposed on a lot of people because they want to accomplish or excel or do something. And
absolutely,
that in and of itself is not wrong. But if their expectations aren't in keeping with reality of where they're at, their present maturity, the fact that human beings are not unlimitedly gifted, we're all limited in some way. So I'm not really great at everything. You know, I might want to be, but it's like my experience is I'm okay at some things, I'm good at others, and there's some things I'm not so good at. And you throw me in that, and it's like I'm going to have to put forth a projection or an illusion to try to feel better. And
I think in relationships too, are going to be some people that I connect with easily, other people, you know, the things that I'm interested in, they're not interested in the same stuff I'm, even if not sandpaper, it's not necessarily negative, but just there's not a clicking of similar passion and heart, and you know, what they're into about Jesus at this particular moment may be way off track from what I'm thinking or into. And I
think if there's a sense that, you know, our favorite, don't should on yourself, but when you are under that compulsion of, well, I should be close to that person, and it's like, but you're not.
Right.
So why should you? The whole realm of freedom is kind of like taking the shoulds off, and it's kind of in search of reality.
Which is what we talked about a couple weeks ago. It's finding where you really are in this journey.
Yeah.
Finding out who you really are, where you really are, what God hasn't fixed in you yet, what he has changed in you and transformed. It just gets to be known for who you are at this point in the journey and the connections that flow off of that, which, I mean, that's, to me, that's what freedom is really about. If I go on this journey without the props that kind of give me an illusion of being okay or being secure, then I find out who he really is, who I really am, and where it is that he's put me in the world, and even where he's placed me in the family. Because it gives me real relationships with people rather than these managed, routine, ritualistic kinds of things that we all grew up in.
Yeah, and if somehow you could take off the sort of spiritual temperature taking or the sort of performance score of how am I doing, I would think most people would really long to know just where am I at in this journey. I mean, I wouldn't think someone would say, oh, I don't want that. But if you're afraid that you're not going to be adequate or up to whatever expectations, then perhaps finding that out is terrifying. And I'd sooner have someone give me a list of things that I can do and achieve because that will prop up my illusion that I'm okay. And I think it's all that shame stuff.
Well, I'm sure it's all that shame stuff. And I think the way that gets undermined, because people just say, well, I'm just gonna be free, which at the beginning stages of this journey, for a lot of people, what they mean by free is I'm going to do whatever it is that I want to do. And they'll find out very quickly that path to indulgence is really not freedom. Just the freedom to do whatever you want to do at any given moment in time is going to lead you.
It's enslavement to your own passions, which isn't really freedom.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe what people who aren't too nuts about freedom say about obligation, was at least saves you from that.
Yes.
But it doesn't allow you to go on to the real relationship. I think what underscores freedom and us being able to embrace that freedom is that I go into that freedom not alone. I go in there with a Father who loves me and is going to help me sort through the things that I'm afraid of, the rejection I might get from people, the wounds I might get from being vulnerable instead of being defensive and protective all the time. I think you can't get there. I get back to this John 15, apart from me, you can do nothing. If we're not in the vine, then freedom is just picking scary, and I do think we'll retreat either in our own defenses, indulgences, or other people's expectations. I do think we'll end up there. But if what happens first, this is what I was trying to say to this guy yesterday, this all flows out of a relationship with him. If you don't have that in a way,
not the invisible bird in the sky.
Yeah, not that bird in the sky guy, but it really flows out of that relationship with him. And if you don't have that in a way that is real to you, makes sense to you, then you are going to want to find rules and principles and things because that's how we've always been taught to live. Yeah, you have a teaching. Here's the 3 points. Here's the conclusion application. You go home and live that way, and that's what it means to live transformed. We've been saying that for a couple of centuries, and or a millennium, actually. And to step back from that and say, wow, this is about knowing Him and taking God into the real events of the day and watching what He's speaking to you, putting on your heart, seeking to follow that. And I said to this guy, that's a language we haven't taught people how to speak. And this is a guy who's been in ministry. He's, you know, retired. He's been an elder. He's been a pastor. He's been a chaplain in a youth correctional facility. He's done an awful lot of ministry things. And some of those have been incredibly fruitful in the way you would measure that externally. And yet he's saying, I don't have a clue what that means. I've never learned to speak that language. I've never learned to listen, to wake up and say, what are you doing in my life today? And how do I begin to recognize?
See, I wonder if it all doesn't flow out of the single fount of knowing that you're loved. Did you think, you know, if I'm going to try to be free, just that pursuit, I'm not sure I even have a radar fix on what that looks like.
Yeah, that's my point. That doesn't work. You know, you can't just go and be free tomorrow.
And it's kind of like, well, free from what? Free from who? Free from there's got to be a something to define the boundaries of something for you to go, then I'm free from. When all of a sudden just love, a gully washer of God's love hits your being, and all of a sudden I know I'm loved, at that moment I'm free from fear. And I'm not focused on freedom. I'm enjoying the freedom of being loved.
Right.
And freedom really isn't the issue. Rules don't come up as the issue. It seems like rules are more important when there isn't the overflow of relationship.
Oh, absolutely.
When I'm trying to go on, you know, navigating, you know, trying to fly a plane. You know, it's like, oh, I got to figure out all the instruments. Okay, but what if you weren't in a plane with a motor and you were just like a bird? And it was just part of you, as opposed to something. It's like, this is me. I fly.
Yeah,
it's just something I do.
I got a better chance of flying a plane today.
But here's the analogy. I think a lot of us use religion like you would use a plane. You're like, well, I'm flying. It's like, no, you're not. You're sitting in an aircraft.
It'd be like taking a bird in an airplane.
Yeah.
And say the bird is flying. Now I get that.
Yeah,
the great bird in the sky.
What's the point of that?
Well, you won't want to move it to New York, and it's just going to take too long for that sparrow to fly to New York on its own.
But wouldn't it be wild to sit there? I mean, think of the lunacy of putting a bird in a plane and then trying to tell the bird, see, you're flying. No. Real flying versus sitting in a plane, nothing close.
Yep.
The reason I know something about this is I know how to fall. I have fallen from heights that for moments you could have said I was flying till I hit.
No, flying involves progress.
But I understand
Not
that.
Not descent.
I understand that. But I think that's what most of us are afraid of. The idea of stepping off a cliff is the fact that, you know what, I'm afraid I can't fly. I'm afraid I will fall, which is why I would sooner backpedal away from that moment, because that's too scary for me. And I think when you look at the real Christian life, it is a message that says, you can fly. You know, as you are being loved, it's like you take flight. And, you know.
And that's really the essence of freedom.
Yeah.
It's not an absence of rules or an absence of all that stuff. The real joy of freedom is, I get to live in Father today. I get to live in His reality, His life, and see what unfolds in my day, rather than starting with this list of rituals and procedures and rules I've got to somehow stick to today.
And I would almost say that I don't think there is such a thing as freedom apart from a someone that I'm in relationship with. It's like, you know, sure, you can have the concept. You can be philosophical about it. But it's like, then we're freedom and we're talking about freedom from principles and rules. And it's like, okay, then you're just back into the dynamics of religion, which may have nothing to do with a person. It has a system to it. It has its doctrines. It has its beliefs. It has its principles. And you can work that. You can navigate that. You can fly that plane. But it's not the same thing as experiencing that freedom of being profoundly loved, and therefore those are not my issues.
And there might be a growth curve in this somehow for people. I know
you
for
think?
Me. Yeah, well, I'm just saying, you know, at this stage in my married life, almost 33 years into it, I don't think I need one rule to tell me how to treat Sarah. I don't think I need one. I don't think I need to know that I should remain faithful. Even if God didn't have a rule against adultery, pretty clear knowing Sarah.
You kind of figured that one out.
That Sarah would. If God doesn't have one, Sarah has one. And my love for Sarah says I wouldn't want to share that with anybody else. I mean, there's an exclusivity to my affection for Sarah that transcends any other relationship that I know or have. Now, when I first got married, I mean, I thought I was madly in love with Sarah and, you know, all the things you promise on your wedding day. And we'd known each other 3.5 years, so we knew each other quite a while, and we'd been dating a long time, and we really loved each other. But when I talk about loving Sarah 32.5 years ago versus loving Sarah today, those words don't even mean the same thing. A lot of loving Sarah 32 years ago, had a lot to do with me and what I wanted out of life and marriage and what I wanted out of Sarah, and had a lot to do with all of that. In the 33 years that's changed, I like what the one guy said after a retreat I taught earlier this last winter. So the law really is how we have to treat people we don't love, which I think is just a great way to say it. And even as Paul pointed out in the shack, the idea that the Ten Commandments being 10 promises. When you know me, you will have no other gods before me. When you know me, you will not commit murder. When you know, they weren't phrases, don't do this and don't do that, as we often think of them. They were really phrased in the future tense. You shall not. You shall not this. You shall not that. I think it's a great way to look at this transformation. In my younger days, when I was told, you know, here's how I should treat Sarah, bring her flowers once in a while, and had all the rules, there may have been some of those that were helpful in forming a relationship. It certainly was helpful to, you know, have the rules to say, you know, don't betray her, because that's, you know, that'll tick God off, is how I learned it growing up. That protected me in some ways. It truly did, until my love could grow to a place where I wouldn't be hurt by my own freedom.
Yeah,
and I'm just thinking
that.
This through.
I get that.
When people say, gosh, there's some security in some of those things, there might be for a time. If your idea of freedom is you're going to take a gun and go shoot your neighbor in the face, I'm thinking you need a rule. You know, you need a law. You need something to tell you. Yeah, not a good idea. And, you know, whatever you're going to sort out with Jesus past that point, it's probably going to be behind bars somewhere, facing a needle someday that's going to end your life. So you make it real. So just to say, gosh, freedom from rules, and people, yeah, well, that's kind of silly. And I guess maybe that's where we really wrestle with this, that freedom, less than God just saying, hey, I don't care what you do, go do whatever, is that true freedom grows out of that relationship that now realizes, I don't need shame to protect me. I don't need fear of people's rejection to motivate me. I don't need my fear that somebody's going to call me out for being bad to keep me good. Now, in that growing walk with Him, I get to live in the joy of that freedom.
Well, it would seem to me, if I was just sort of distilling some of what you've been saying, the love that comes out of the depth of knowing seems to replace the need for rules about it.
Absolutely it does. It, you know, transcends that. It transcends.
Yeah, it's like...
Because now the rule seems cheap.
Yeah.
To say my relationship with Sarah is defined by my promise never to commit adultery till I die, that just seems like...
That doesn't explain anything of it.
It's still true, but it's just cheap.
Yeah.
It cheapens it.
And I think one of the biggest challenges is, like, you know, your depth of knowing somebody sort of broadens your capacity to understand, quote, love and being loved. Because you would say you love Sarah more deeply today, that the words pale in comparison to 30-some years ago.
But it doesn't mean the same thing.
Yeah.
What I meant by love back then had mostly to do with me. What it means now is it has mostly to do with Sarah.
But probably there's a depth and a dimensionality to your love that grows with maturity and knowing, that it's sort of like it's larger, it's enhanced. And I think when you look at God's knowledge of us, I don't know myself but a fraction. God knows me through and through. You know, He knows the very hairs on my head. I couldn't tell you how many there are. I don't know that aspect. And His depth of knowing is also there with a depth and a breadth of love for what He knows. It's not this, well, He's God, He has to. I sort of feel like, you know, we end up thinking like, well, God is love and He has to love us, but if He had a choice, He really wouldn't. And it's like, I don't think we've been touched by the fact that, you know what, it is a volitional love, I think, even in His own heart.
That He has great affection for us.
Yeah.
And I really
and
don't
I think it's choice.
Yep.
I don't think he has to. I think it's because he knows what I am. He created me. He knows what has been invested in me. And he could probably talk for eternity the reasons why he has a volitional love and appreciation for what's in me, whether I am in touch with that or not. That's his love for me.
Yeah, and it makes you even transcend all of those things. Because when the first, I was not looking forward to being a grandpa. I wasn't regretting it. I wasn't fearing it. But I just, it was not a thought I had until my daughter got pregnant, and then she had this baby. The first moment we all looked at Amy, at least me, man, I had more affection for her than most other people I know. From what? It's my daughter's child, certainly, but I was just, and it wasn't even because of her worth. It wasn't anything she'd do for me. It just was, man, I love that little kid. And when she was nothing more than a blob on my chest, sleeping while I watched a football game and, you know, unable to do anything else, the great affection you feel, that affection really doesn't grow for her. The reality of it grows now as we sit down today. She was over this morning and we're talking, she's just talking all over the place about all kinds of things she's doing with her little life now. She's almost three. That relationship takes on a greater dynamic. You know, I sat there and looked at her today. I don't know that I love her more than I loved her the first day I held her, when she didn't have any of those other things. But there's just that bond, that connection
But your depth of knowing and appreciation.
Yeah, it gives more opportunity.
Yeah, maybe that's a better way to say that. Because I think one of the challenges that we have in terms of that sense of loving and being loved by God is I don't think we know very much about God. So the depth of, quote, my love for him, if it has any relationship to a sense of knowing, if you don't have any sense of intimacy and you feel like a complete stranger to God, like if he was walking down the street, could I pick him out of the crowd? If right. he was veiled in human right. flesh, you're just going like, gosh, maybe that's the predicament that a number of people are in, that you just need to find that new starting point. God, I need to say, with all honesty, the wisdom of Paul, I don't know you. I want to.
Yeah,
I'm open to revelation. Please help me in that
right,
department.
Absolutely. And it's not just knowing about, because there are people who know an awful lot about God.
I mean,
got the theology down. I mean, every time I hear theological discussions these days, I used to enjoy them quite a bit. You know, parsing out God, thinking this way, that way. Man, I just, knowing about him and knowing him are really two different realities.
Different universes, yes.
Yeah, and it's not that the knowing about isn't helpful, because there's facts about your life I know that helps our friendship grow, but it's really more than the facts of your life. And, you know, I could write down a whole paper on the personality of Brad Cummings, but there's nothing I could put in that paper that would be equal to the person or to the relationship. It's just not. Knowing you is different than anything I would know about you.
And that's true of the Bible.
Absolutely.
I mean, there's a lot of great stuff in there, and that is, it's got the very stuff of God there, but he's bigger than that.
Yeah.
That doesn't do a sufficient job of fully making God that real to me. It's helpful. It's a stepping stone to a relationship. But in and of itself, it's not going to do the complete job.
Yeah, if we don't find him in it and through it and transcending it, then it will be a limitation. It just will limit what we get to know about him and what we get to experience in him, because I'm finding it in my intellectual propositions rather than I'm finding it in a growing relationship with a real being.
You know, it seems to me that when you look at the early disciples and Jesus calling the 12, it's like there's a bunch of brothers, a bunch of pairs. It's kind of like, oh, you got to meet this guy. It was a friend bringing another friend to this guy that just overwhelmed them to the very core of their being. That's how this thing grew.
Yep.
What we have today passed along is propositions and truths and systematic doctrines and all that stuff. And somehow it's like, okay, learn all this, and then you're one of us. And you're just going like, gosh, the whole concept of it being normative, that you met a man, a person, you know him for yourself. Yeah. Nobody can tell you you didn't meet him.
Right.
I mean, if someone were to try to say, you know what, you didn't meet Wayne Jacobson, I'd simply laugh. I wouldn't argue about it. I'd go like, really? You know, what are you smoking?
Who was that masked man?
Because, You know, I mean, even if they went through systematically tried to disprove how you're not Wayne, I'd kind of laugh at the end of the day, going like, gosh, you know, I'm pretty past that point.
I find that's true when people tell me sometimes what it is that they think I believe. And I'll say, you know what, I'm not really on that page. You go, oh, yes, you are. And I'm like, now, who would know better? Unless I'm just out and out lying to you, who would know better if that's my thought or if this is my thought? I would know better. But, you know, people read, they'll quote this and say, well, you've got me in this little box. That then you're quoting this thing that proves that box works, but I'm telling you, I'm not in that box, and that quote doesn't prove that I am. But boy, it's hard to convince that. I think what we get down to with this, though, because in the end, even with the early believers, if it was friends of friends of friends, and they introduced people to Christ, and, you know, John's passion in 1 John was that you'll come to know him. Our fellowship is with him, what we handled and tasted, and our fellowship is with you, and yours is with him. It's to bridge them in that same connection. And yet, we have most of Paul's epistles written to groups of believers who obviously started out with an introduction to the risen Christ and ended up practicing a religion that they didn't call Christianity back then, we do today, that he's got to write Galatians and Ephesians and 2 Corinthians and all these books to say...
Fair amount of bewitching and leading away from the simplicity and purity of devotion.
Yeah, what did you do? Why did we substitute? And almost in every case... There was some people, and this time men, mostly always men, super apostles, he called them in 2 Corinthians, people who come in to say, no, you can't do it that way. You've got to do it my way. And how quickly people fell for that. That's what's scary. In the 2,000-year history of believers in Christ, keeping people on the free range is the bigger challenge.
Well, you don't stop at 2,000 years. You go back into the Old Testament with Samuel and Saul, and it's like, well, we want to be like the other nations. We want a king. And it's like, excuse me, you have one. It is the living God.
We need a cage and a head chicken. Is that what we need?
It would appear...
Because we can't see the big invisible bird in the sky, so we want a big chicken in the roost telling us what to do. And I do think that is compromise. Even in the early believers, that compromises the vitality of this gospel they wanted them to know. This is a life in him. It's not about practicing a new religion and going to a bunch of meetings and following a bunch of rules and spouting a bunch of theology. It is a relationship in him that grows in transforming us so that we can really be God's free people on the earth.
Yeah, and I do think that, sadly, when it would seem like when a group appoints a leader, I mean, you can see this as goofy as I'm watching Survivor.
Yeah.
The minute someone identifies themselves as a leader, they're the next guy voted off.
We watch Survivor, too, around my family. You know what? The first time they identify themselves as Christians, they get kicked off.
Well, I'd vote them off, too. I get irritated with that.
But it is. Let's talk about that a little bit. I find Christians in those settings horribly irritating, and they don't even see it about themselves.
It was God's will. He kept me here long enough.
I found in the political world I deal with rich builders, the most obnoxious people at the table are Christians, and it's okay if they were obnoxious and knew they were. They don't have a clue.
Yeah, they don't know. They don't know.
They really think they're being humble and kind and compassionate. Everybody around them is rolling their eyes and shaking their head.
I forget the radio talk show host that was on this last Survivor that got bounced out.
Yeah,
and that
never
says, well, God had me here just, you know, the number of times that he wanted me here.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
The biggest joy I had at the moment was both of my sons rolling their eyes.
Oh, yeah.
Discerning that, what a... piece of crap that
watch
was.
Watch it.
You know, I mean, but it was just sort of funny when I looked at him like, so you guys weren't real jazzed? No, that's so lame, Dad. She got herself voted off. That was nothing about God.
Well, you see Ann Coulter this week trying to talk to one of the talk show hosts who's a Jew about, you know, we're all Jews need to be perfected. And she's using language that's horribly offensive and arrogant to Jews. And the guy's even saying, do you realize how offensive it is? I'm not being offensive. What? And I do think people who are not living in the freedom of who Christ is, who live with this, I'm going to make you conform to my rules, or my rules are the best rules, and I'm trying to get the world to embrace it, they are obnoxious, and they're actually... harming the cause of Christ in the world, but they don't have a clue.
No,
they don't know at all.
Because if they were relating to a person, that person, they would feel emanating from that person. Hey,
You're an idiot.
Back off.
Yeah.
But if you're relating to the God of your rules, look, that thing is completely under your interpretive control.
Yeah, when you relate to the God, when you relate to the God of your rules, you're submitting to yourself.
Yeah, and
that's
you,
exactly
and,
right.
And you have complete interpretive control that you can even rationalize when it doesn't fit. You just sort of rearrange the image of the God of your rules under your new interpretation. See, genuine Jesus didn't like that. And even the black and white rules, it would seem he fudges into a little measure of gray because in one situation,
well, now
you
you're
can go
like
this
a
way.
Relativist now.
No, but I'm not. But I do know that it's like, gosh, it's not like situational ethics. It's like the person of Jesus in that situation, knowing the fullness of the people involved, doesn't just apply principles. He loves people. And he loves them differently
right.
and in different ways, which is why if you're led by him in his spirit, principles don't work.
And you really want people who are growing in freedom to be growing in the character of Christ. Otherwise, you're just more free to be as obnoxious as you want to be. And I do think this freedom of knowing who he is as a person allows us, as we grow in freedom, to live in a way that engages people to the God we know and isn't so obnoxious that we turn them off.
No, and I think that's where the whole idea of the fear of and the craving for intimacy. I think deep is calling unto deep. That's I want that.
People want it, even if they're scared of it.
Yeah, I want that. But it's like I think we're afraid. I thought about this years ago when I recognized what's the issue that keeps me from God. And it's like I had to dethrone the God of my impressions for the God who really is. Because I recognize, you know, if God is just my best self projected to the nth degree,
it's not.
But it's like most of us think, well, that's really good.
That's not who he is.
I recognize I would reject me. And that's what I'm afraid of at the end of the day is that if that's the only image I have of God, if the expression, the fullness of his goodness is just my goodness projected to the nth degree, if that's all I got, then it's going to be a wall because at the end of the day, I know me and I have reasons for why at the end of the day, I would disqualify me. And God had to dethrone that over and over. He kept saying, Brad, I'm not like you. And I found that initially really offensive. It's like, what? Because it was in moments when I thought I was doing well. And he was trying to say, your goodness, your concept of goodness is just falling so painfully short of who I really am. And that's where I sat there going like, well, God, you know, I was still in my performance mode of, well, I'm doing the best I can as if somehow I'm feeling dinged because I couldn't quite grasp his goodness. And I couldn't even understand. It's like, Brad, this isn't about dinging you. It's about freeing you.
Hmm.
I'm bigger. I'm better. I'm more wonderful than what you know. And I finally had to just sort of exhaust myself on that road and go like, all right, fine. Then who are you? And It's when I sat there that all of a sudden it seemed like the gears started to shift.
Which is what the New Testament warns us. God thinks exactly the opposite about almost everything we think. And that's why there's no substitute for knowing him as a real presence and having a sense of what he's about and what he's doing in our lives. Because otherwise we're just going to project, whether it's our best interpretations of scripture or our best interpretations of our best self or whatever, we're going to keep missing the mark. He needs to take on this reality in our lives as the God who really is. And the God who can make himself known to every one of us and wants to more than anything.
Thank you for traveling with us on The God Journey. You can be part of the conversation by visiting our website, thegodjourney.com,